ticks, Lyme disease, and other vector-borne diseases. It's a sad reality that many people have become more and more reluctant to enjoy Maine's great outdoors in the warmer months, whether it's hiking, camping, or just hanging out in the backyard. No thanks to the prevalence of ticks that carry Lyme disease, not to mention other bugs like mosquitoes that can cause serious illnesses as well. I'm Cindy Hahn. Join me in a panel of experts for the latest update on ticks and other threats this season. We'll discuss how to identify ticks, some preventive measures to take, what symptoms to watch for, and when to seek treatment. We'll also hear about how to protect your pets and talk about some of the other vector-borne diseases like anaplasmosis, powassan, and West Nile. Maine Calling is next, but first this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Cindy Hahn, and this is Maine Calling. It's amazing how much power tiny creatures like ticks and mosquitoes can have over us. The threat of getting Lyme disease or West Nile virus can stop us from fully enjoying being outdoors. Today, we'll learn just how real those threats are and how you can best avoid them. Joining me in the studio, Michelle Walsh. She's Maine State Veterinarian. Chuck Lubelchik, he's a vector ecologist with the Lyme and Vector-Borne Disease Laboratory, which is part of Maine Medical Center's Research Institute. And Rob Smith, he's director and founder of the Vector-Borne Disease Lab and director of the Division of Infectious Disease at Maine Medical Center. As always, we want to hear from you. Do you have questions about ticks and what to do if you find one on you? Are you worried about Lyme disease or other illnesses that bugs can carry? Our phone number is 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Chuck, I'm going to start with you because you're out there looking at bugs and looking at ticks all the time. Can you tell us how things are looking this year in terms of ticks and Lyme disease?
The tick-wise, it's a very good year for the ticks.
In terms of good from whose perspective?
Good from the ticks' perspective. Okay. Bad from our perspective. The winter was kind of snow-covered enough to allow the ticks to survive. A lot of the colder temperatures that are out. And with all the moisture we've had this spring, the biggest limit to ticks this time of year is drying and desiccation. So they dry out in the woods as stuff is greening. Water's pulled out of the soil and ticks dry out. But we've had a lot of rain this year. And so the ticks and mosquitoes this spring are doing really, really well.
What does that mean in terms of are there already documented cases of Lyme disease?
Well, the State Health Department has been documenting cases of both Lyme and anaplasmosis. And we are seeing from our lab that especially, again, typically along the southern coast, southwestern coast in particular, the numbers of ticks are quite high. But we are seeing them inland into Kennebec County as well as in areas of the Downeast as well.
Okay. And Rob, I understand that last year, 2018, it was the first time there was not a rise in Lyme cases in Maine, and they actually went down by a bit. Does that tell us anything, and will this year show if there's a trend or not?
It's hard to know. It's true that last year the number of cases were lower than the last few years. They've been kind of going up over about 5 years. But it was also a dry, hot summer, and the nymphal ticks became less apparent. I think there were fewer questing at a time when people were outdoors. So time will tell whether we see this plateau or we see a continued increase in the next year or two.
Okay, so we'll watch what happens this year. And Michelle, maybe you can, we have to go back to a basic tick primer first. As we talk about these ticks, how many different kinds of ticks do we have here in Maine? Which one's the one to watch out for? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure, and I'm going to invite Chuck to jump in here if I miss any, but the most prevalent ticks we see on our companion animals anyways are the Ixodes tick, the black-legged tick, the deer tick. That's all the same tick. And the American dog tick. And we also have other ticks afoot, but those are the two that are most commonly encountered by humans and our companion animals.
Yeah. And as Maine State veterinarian, you're looking at how they affect what kinds of animals?
Primarily livestock and poultry. That's my purview. But we certainly, all of us who have companion animals, see ticks frequently on those animals. And those are actually the animals that probably bring them in contact with humans most commonly. So although that's really not something that I deal with as the state veterinarian per se, when I was a veterinarian in clinical practice and as a pet owner, I certainly see, I encounter ticks and interact with ticks in that way.
If your dog runs out in the woods and comes home and they're bringing the ticks to the family.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. And Chuck, maybe you can fill in a little further about there are, what, 14 different kinds of ticks or how many different kinds?
Yeah, we've got about 14, many of which people are never going to encounter because they're on very specific wildlife hosts like seabirds or what we would call mustelids or like fishers, marten, weasels. But the dog tick and the deer tick are very ubiquitous across the state now, and they love a variety of hosts, including us and our dogs and cats.
And the deer tick is the one that can carry Lyme.
Yes, it is in the Northeast. It vectors at least 5 different pathogens, all of which we found in Maine, Lyme being the most common.
So how does somebody know if it's a deer tick as opposed to a dog tick?
This time of year, the deer ticks are going to be quite small. They are the nymphal life stage, which we can think of as the middle life stage. They're the ones that cause the most human disease, but they're about the size of the head of a pin, so they're quite tiny. In contrast, the dog ticks this time of year are quite large, so they're looking at close to 1/8 of an inch in size, very noticeable, and they have some kind of white on the back.
And do other ticks other than the deer tick cause problems in humans or animals?
Yes, they can. In certain parts of the country, they're a much bigger problem than here. So some parts of the country, Rocky Mountain spotted fever, which is carried by dog ticks, is a problem. In the southern U.S., something called ehrlichiosis, carried by Lone Star ticks, is a significant problem. In Maine, it's almost entirely, the diseases we see are almost entirely attributable to deer ticks. There are a couple of caveats. There's a little tick that looks a lot like a deer tick called a woodchuck tick, which people relatively rarely get bitten by, but it can be a cause of an encephalitis virus. It's quite rare, but it's there.
And can you continue with just what actually happens when a tick bites somebody? How does it transmit disease?
Well, they're really well designed to transmit the diseases that they carry. This is something that's happened with evolution over millennia between the tick and usually mice or other mammal hosts. And so the tick, when it attaches to you, inserts a kind of tick saliva that actually is full of very interesting compounds that are getting a lot of attention because of their potential role for vaccines. But that aside, these things include chemicals that open your blood vessels, that anticoagulate your blood, and that decrease inflammation. So when you get bitten by the tick, you often don't know it because of the chemicals it's inserting as it does this. And this works to the tick's advantage because it gives it time to be on you or the mammal that would try to groom it off. And during that time, these pathogens that have co-evolved with the tick are able to multiply and invade the host. And so they get to, so win-win for the tick and win-win for the pathogens, but not for us.
And that's why it takes a while before you know.
Yes,
if you can confirm someone, for example, has Lyme disease.
Well, there are a couple issues there. The first is that it takes a while for the tick to transmit Lyme disease. And we know from animal studies and some human data that usually 36 to 48 hours is the critical time for infection of humans or mice by the deer tick with the Lyme disease bacterium. It may be a little shorter for some of the other agents that these ticks carry, and may be very short for a rare virus, Powassan virus, that the ticks carry. But in general, it takes a couple of days of feeding before there's a high level of transmission of Lyme disease.
Okay, let's go to another basic question. What happens when a tick bites somebody or you find a tick on you? What are the first steps?
Don't use petroleum jelly or Vaseline to smother the tick.
So that's a myth.
That's a myth. Don't use a match or a hot pin to burn it off of you. That's also a myth and makes the tick upset. And
What does an upset tick do?
Well, it actually may regurgitate the contents back into you a little bit faster than it otherwise might. So we really recommend, there's a variety of tick pullers that you can get from veterinarians or at outdoor supply places that work, as well as using a fiery fine pair of tweezers to gently pull. In many cases, morphologically, these ticks have a beak, or hypostome we would call it, that has recurved hooks. So it's actually anchored into your skin pretty well. So it actually takes a little bit of patience pulling the tick out of you, really ripping it out very quickly. You can sometimes leave a part of the tick under your skin, which may cause a secondary infection like a splinter would. But in general, a gentle patient tugging will help to get the tick off in one piece.
Okay, so by experience,
yeah.
I had, a part of it still left in my leg when I was trying to pull out a tick. And other than it possibly causing infection, is it continuing to is that little head, beak, or whatever that part is, it's not continuing to burrow or spout out something?
No, it'll eventually slough off the way a sliver or a splinter would. You'll eventually pass it out and push it out of your body. Usually there can be a secondary infection, though, so we usually recommend if that does happen, topical antiseptic and thoroughly wash the site of the bite.
Okay. It was very annoying. And what do you do then with the tick? Do you send it somewhere?
Well, the University of Maine Cooperative Extension has a program for tick identification that took over from our lab back in 2014, and they now are the place to send ticks for identification. They will take any tick. I believe it's either a minimal cost or it might be free for identification, and there's a minimal cost, again, for testing those ticks if you want to send them into the University of Maine.
So should people do that, or is that just an optional, I want to find out kind of thing?
If they don't know what the tick is, then it's a good idea to send it up to identify the tick at least. Because, you know, we do get a couple different kinds of ticks on people. If they can't tell what it is, they will even accept digital photographs. And nowadays, with a lot of our smartphones, we have really good cameras. So they will accept a digital photo in exchange for the actual tick.
So that's a lot quicker.
Yeah.
Okay,
yep.
Great. And Michelle, what about if you find a tick on your dog or your cat?
Right. Well, the method of removing the tick is exactly the same as with humans. That's why Chuck did mention, thank you, that you can get tick pulling devices or removing devices from your veterinarian's office often. Also, the Maine Department of Agriculture, through our entomologist's office, has some tick spoons, which are a great device to slide under the tick and then pull straight out. So same method of removal. We also recommend, veterinarians typically will recommend that when you come in from the outside or when your pets come in from the outside, that you actually check them for ticks at that time before the tick is actually attached. So, or wipe them down with a towel, something like that, so that you actually are physically removing the tick before it can attach. Do check the towel and shake it outside so that you're not actually dislodging them into your home, where they'll then probably quest for you.
You've all mentioned questing. What exactly does that mean?
So my understanding questing is the tick's way of attaching itself, securing itself on some kind of vegetation or some substrate where it can then take advantage of you walking by or a mammal walking by. So it grabs on with six legs and then quests with two. So it waves those really creepy looking appendages that it has and grabs on as you go by.
Ah.
Did I get that right?
Yeah, they're constantly
really sinister, these little guys. Mm-hmm. And when you said to search your pet to see if they have ticks, is there any tips on how to do that if they're a shaggy or darker colored animal?
So I think that we underestimate our ability to actually, our fingers are incredibly sensitive. So especially when we are patting our dogs or our cats, lumps and bumps, our brain will register that. So running your hand on the areas of the animal that would typically have ticks around the head, around the tail, and then remember that ticks come from the ground up. They do not drop from trees. They do not jump. So that's
important.
Yes.
I think people don't know
and we'll
that.
Probably talk more about that a little bit later in the show, my guess is. But, you know, just running your hands over those areas of the animal that they're typically found, that ticks are typically found, is a really good way to your hands are probably more sensitive than your eyes.
Okay, good to know. So we've talked about Lyme disease just barely, but we wanted to, I'd like to hear more about the symptoms. If you know you've had a tick bite, what are you looking for?
You want to watch the area where the tick had bitten you. Now, first of all, you may get a little red reaction, an itchy red spot where the tick bit you right away. If that happens, that's not indicative of Lyme disease. That's a reaction to these substances the tick has put in under your skin. So you can watch that area, and that should subside in a couple of days. But if at that site or at any point you start to see a round or oval flat red spot, and usually these things are several inches in diameter when they first appear, typically up to about 5 or 6 inches on average, in a place that you didn't know there was a tick bite, or at the site that you had the tick bite, then that would be typical for the rash that's largely specific for Lyme disease called erythema migrans. And that rash is present in about 70 to 80, or some reports say even 90% of people who get Lyme disease, and is a really helpful telltale sign that you've been infected by a tick. And the one point to make is that most of the time people don't know that a tick had bit them at the site where the rash appears. So the fact that you weren't aware of a tick bite doesn't mean it's couldn't be Lyme disease. These things appear a few days to even a month after the tick bite, and gradually, if not treated, the rash will increase in size. And it's not raised, and it's not particularly itchy, and it's not painful. One pitfall I want to point out that's a common thinking among medical residents and medical providers in the public is that you're looking for a bullseye rash. And it's clear that early on, this rash is more typically not a bullseye rash. It's just a red circular rash. It may be the same color red all through, or maybe more red in the center. Another pitfall is that you can have more than one of these. So if you have a strain of Lyme disease that spreads quickly, some people will present with one rash, but then with a number of circular rashes, often on their trunk. And this isn't sometimes recognized as Lyme disease, but it's known as disseminated erythema migrans.
Okay, that's tricky. We have a lot more to talk about as far as Lyme disease and the other diseases that can be caused by vectors like ticks. And we'll talk about this more after a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Simply Sized Home, downsizing and moving management specialists serving southern and mid-coast Maine. Learn more at simplysizedhome.com. And the Lunder Foundation, founding partner of Maine Public Radio and Maine Public Classical.
More than 12,000 babies are born every year in Maine. Most will need childcare, but there's not enough. Parents face wait lists that run months, even years, to get a slot.
You feel like you're trying to get a job, like, pick me, don't you want my child?
That's just a piece of it, is the availability. Then there's the, how do you pay for it?
Tune in starting June 24th all week as Maine Public takes a deep dive into childcare. On air and at mainepublic.org/childcare.
Thinking about donating your used vehicle to Maine Public? Doing so from now through the end of June is a good time. Not only will it be towed away for free and you could get a possible tax credit, but also our friends at Lee Auto Malls will provide a $500 Lee certificate for use towards the purchase of any new or used vehicle at any Lee Auto Malls location around the state. For complete information, please visit mainepublic.org and click on the banner or click on the events dropdown. Thanks.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Cindy Hahn. Today on the program, what to do about ticks, Lyme disease, and other similar threats. Joining me, Rob Smith, director of Maine Med's Lyme and Vector-Borne Disease Lab, Chuck Lubelchik, vector ecologist with the Lyme and Vector-Borne Disease Lab, and Michelle Walsh, Maine State veterinarian. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. And we will go now to Wade, K. Wade Burton. He's joining me on the line, and he is with IDEX, where he's the medical affairs specialist. Thanks for calling in, Wade.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
And tell us, I know you work with animals and dogs. Tell us about screening dogs for Lyme disease. Is that essential?
Yes, especially in Maine. It's critical that we screen our pets for these tick-borne diseases that you've been discussing. It's been pretty consistent over the last at least 7 or 8 years that we find 13% of the ticks of the dogs tested have been exposed to Lyme and anaplasma in the state of Maine. So it's very common.
Okay, what about cats?
It is less common in cats. There are reports of Lyme disease in cats. It doesn't as often cause disease, but there are obviously other things that in cats can cause problems that are tick-borne as well that we certainly don't want these external parasites on our pets because, as y'all have already discussed, many of these diseases that these ticks are carrying affect both dogs and people.
Okay, so what kind of comprehensive vector-borne disease testing is recommended then for pets?
Well, we would certainly recommend that you do have your pet screened annually for not just for Lyme and anaplasma, but for Ehrlichia and heartworm too. The SNAP 40X Plus test that IDEX has, we offer both as an in clinic at your veterinarian, or they can send it to our reference lab. Gives you a good comprehensive screening because you do have all four diseases present in the state of Maine. Although Lyme and anaplasma are much more common, we do see cases of pets exposed to ehrlichiosis and heartworms that are carried by mosquitoes as well.
Okay, and where can people get more information about all of this?
Their family veterinarian is certainly a good source, as y'all referred to before. I would also recommend they check out the Companion Animal Parasite Council's website. CAPC has a lot of good pet owner information, as well as at IDEX.com and Pet Health Network are all good sources of information for the pet owner. But their veterinarian often has a lot of information, especially in places where tick-borne disease is this common. I'd urge them to contact their veterinarian and work with their veterinarian for an overall tick control program that includes screening as well as the tick control to try to keep the ticks off the pets and the family.
Great. Well, thank you, Wade. We'll try to share some of those resources on our website. Kay Wade Burton is Medical Affairs Specialist at IDEX. And Michelle, I just wanted to follow up with what he talked about. So if your pet is exposed to disease, what does that mean for the family members?
So it doesn't, the good news, if we have a good news on this tick program, is that it, we need the tick to actually transfer the disease to the people, whether they're infected with a by a wild mammal. The most common route of infection for the tick is wildlife, just to be clear. So if your dog has Lyme disease, you are not at higher risk as a person in the household to get Lyme disease or Ehrlichia or Anaplasma, the three diseases that Wade just mentioned.
So that just your dog needs treatment.
Correct.
Just as people do.
Possibly, okay. Yes. If they're showing clinical signs of disease. And actually, when veterinarians screen our pets for these diseases, one of the current protocols is to actually typically administer antibiotic treatment at that time for the pet.
Okay. And we were just touching upon that with humans. When Rob was talking about when you spot the target rash or other signs, what then do you do treatment-wise?
Sure. If you suspect Lyme disease, we recommend treating for it with standard approach, which is usually a couple of weeks of a well-tolerated and inexpensive antibiotic that's quite effective. So that is pretty clear-cut. If they have complications of Lyme disease, let's say it's Lyme arthritis, a longer course of treatment is usually recommended. Fortunately, one of the antibiotics we use commonly for early Lyme disease in all stages, also works very well for anaplasmosis. So if you're using that particular antibiotic, you're going to be knocking out both of those bacteria at the same time. Not entirely true for all the things the tick can carry. So there's another organism called babesiosis, which is sort of a malaria-like parasite in some ways, and that requires, it's rarer, but it requires a different treatment than Lyme disease and anaplasmosis.
Well, one of the dilemmas I've always heard is that by the time you test positive for Lyme, it's sort of too late to have started a course of antibiotics. So you treat it when you have any little suspicion of it, then you just go ahead and treat. Is that correct?
No, it's not really too late to treat. But I think what you're referring to is that when you test for Lyme disease at the time of the rash, the test is only 50-50 in terms of being positive. So you want to treat on your clinical suspicion that this rash is erythema migrans or that they have this tick-borne infection. And recognizing that the blood test takes about 4 to 6 weeks to turn positive after infection starts. If you're 2 or 3 months down the line and you've had symptoms during that time, the tests are very, very helpful and have a very high sensitivity, meaning they're almost always positive if Lyme disease is the cause of the test, of the symptoms.
Okay. Chuck, go ahead.
And I just want to say about the vet end of things, you know, in a lot of ways, too, dogs and cats are a lot more exposed to these ticks than we are, and especially where the ticks are just getting started, like in areas like northern Maine or down east Maine, they provide very good sentinels because they are oftentimes the first ones to get the ticks, and communication with vets is pretty important because they oftentimes know where these ticks are just starting out, and so we try to keep vets in the loop with a lot of this communication as well.
That brings me to the fact that you actually survey what's out there and when. So what's happening with that right now? How do you do that?
Well, right now we have a very high-tech method that we call tick dragging, which is we get a piece of corduroy or flannel, attach it to a pole, and we very zen-like walk through the woods and collect the ticks that are out there. It's quite relaxing, actually.
Only for you, Tom.
Only for me. But so we can then take those ticks, if we get a big enough sample size, and we can test and get an infection rate in an area or a site. And this is helpful for a lot of our research, but this year we're also doing a lot of statewide surveillance in cooperation with the Maine Health Department, our Maine CDC, because the federal CDC now has guidelines for doing surveillance, and they're trying to get a lot of the states lined up, all following the same protocol. So it's very, so the data is very applicable across state boundaries. So we comparing to New Hampshire or Vermont or Massachusetts. So we're in the process now of trying to survey statewide for black-legged ticks or other ticks, and then also get those ticks tested to find infection prevalence.
Okay. And speaking of federal and state research and funding on all this, Rob, do you know much about, I guess, Senator Susan Collins as well as Senator King have introduced legislation to address prevention and treatment of ticks and Lyme?
Yes, I saw that. I'm not familiar with the details of the bill, but I understand that it would provide increased funding, particularly for states that are having significant burden from tick-borne diseases, and support for the CDC, which has some regional centers for research on vector-borne diseases. So I think these are all needed areas for investment in terms of these diseases. We've seen a marked increase in the Northeast, but also the upper Midwest and other parts of the U.S. of numbers of tick-borne diseases, and then a recognition that it's not one disease, it's not Lyme disease, but a number of different diseases that we need to pay attention to. So there's certainly a need for continued active and robust research.
Okay. We'll go to a question now. An email from Julia. Do you recommend dosing kids with antibiotics in the summer to prevent Lyme, even if we see no evidence of tick bites, but they've been in tick-infested areas? So antibiotics preventively?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
Julia's asking whether you recommend dosing kids with antibiotics in the summer to prevent Lyme, even if there's no evidence of tick bites, but they have been in tick-infested areas.
That hasn't been a recommendation, to my knowledge, from any of the standard medical bodies. We do use an antibiotic in some patients who remove a deer tick. If you think you've been bitten by a deer tick, and you remove it within 72 hours of finding it, and if the tick's been feeding on you, so it's somewhat, it's not a flat tick, there is evidence that you can lower your risk of Lyme disease by taking one dose of an antibiotic called doxycycline. And so we do get calls in the summer regarding that situation and recommending a single dose. And what that does is it lowers your risk. A lot of people think the risk would be quite high from a tick they remove from themselves, but the average risk in the studies was around 4% of people who removed a tick developed Lyme disease when they weren't, when nothing was done, and you lowered that down to about a 0.5% if you took this dose of doxycycline. So it did have efficacy, and sometimes people will call and will do that.
For pets, though, when we're talking about prevention, Michelle, the dogs at least can take these various different medications like by pill or by application that can basically ward off ticks.
Right. So you're talking about tick preventatives now, not something that you actually put on or in your pet to prevent the ticks from actually attaching to the pet. There's quite a variety of those on the market. That field has really expanded. And probably the best resource for people to know what's appropriate for their pet and for their family, and I mean for the pets in the family, because we don't put these on people, is your family veterinarian. There's such a variety of product available. All of them are in usually two classes of insecticide. It's usually either organophosphates or synthetic pyrethroids. But some of them cannot be put on cats and are actually very toxic to cats. So like I said, it's very important to consult with your family veterinarian about what the best choice is. There are also some that are topical, so you actually squeeze it on the hair coat of the pet. Or now there's some, in the old days, it used to be all oral. So the tick actually has to bite the pet to actually get exposed to the chemical that acts as, and there's some repellency associated with some of those products as well. But anyways, because of the variety of choices and the toxicity to cats for some, it's really important that you talk to a vet about that.
So it begs two questions. Mm-hmm. One is if it's enough to kill the tick that bites, then how is it not harming the pet to have this insecticide inside them?
Yeah, that's a great question. These are insecticides. These are not pesticides or something that's harmful to mammals. There are instructions on these packages that all talk about the safe application, where you put them on the pet, when you put them on the pet, and what to do. The human who applies these chemicals should also abide by certain preventative measures to prevent them from ingesting it or, you know, having too much skin exposure, et cetera. So you treat them like you treat any drug. You read the instructions, you follow the instructions carefully, and you abide by any warnings on the package.
So the second question I was going to say, and I we've heard this before on the show, is why is there not something like that for humans?
Right. That's I've heard this question asked. I was asked this when I was in clinical practice as well. I'm not sure what the answer to that is. I mean, there are clinical trials that these preventatives undergo in the pet world, and I'm not sure that those have ever been done on humans. One, you know, the lifespan of our pets is considerably shorter than ours. So perhaps the repeated exposure to these chemicals may not be healthy for all mammals, but certainly they're considered safe for our pets. Again, they undergo extensive clinical testing to make sure that that is true. The other thing to remember is that a lot of these, especially the topical products, their efficacy is significantly decreased when the pet swims or is bathed. So think about how frequently we bathe or swim.
You'd have
it's
to do
usually
it every
bathing.
Day.
Yeah, the reapplication is important. But there are very effective repellents available for people, and I'll let my human health colleagues here talk about that.
Prevention, repellents, all of that.
Yeah. One of them that is really getting a lot of use now, and that wasn't the case 20 years ago, is a compound called permethrin that will go on clothing. And this is actually used also in one of the topicals that can go on dogs as well. And permethrin will go on clothing. You can also buy clothing impregnated with permethrin from companies. But it's a fairly effective tick-killing and repellent compound that can go on any kind of fabric, although it adheres better to cotton or natural fibers as opposed to synthetic fibers. But it is very effective at preventing tick bites. The other ones that are commonly used are DEET or some of the other topicals that can go on skin. And these may also go on fabric, but their primary use is to go on skin. And they do need to be reapplied, though, because the more you sweat, the more wet you get. If you're outside recreating, you're going to need to do reapplications. The benefit to permethrin is that it can last for several wash cycles in your clothing. So if you spray your pants, your shirt once, you can go maybe a couple of weeks, hopefully, before having to retreat again.
Okay, we have an email from Todd. My mother-in-law, Lynn Snow of Thomaston, Maine, died several years ago from a tick bite. She was a healthy, happy grandmother before the Powassan virus took her life barely 8 weeks after she was bit. Take this issue seriously. To avoid ticks, wear tall, slick rubber boots with insect repellent sprayed on the outside. Wear long pants tucked into your socks. Tuck your long-sleeve shirt into your pants and then tuck the sleeves into gloves. This will block the ticks from reaching your exposed skin. And when you come inside, throw all the clothes into the dryer set on high. This will kill any ticks that have attached.
Yep, that's all correct.
Okay, well, thank you for your email, Todd. And believe it or not, we need to take another quick break. And when we come back, more of your questions and comments. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do InSource Renewables, committed to providing renewable energy solutions that support Maine's communities, workers, and the planet. InSourceRenewables.com. And United Way's Women United, sponsor of Deep Dive Childcare, a new in-depth series from Maine Public News beginning June 24th. Learn more at mainepublic.org.
I don't remember driving away or saying goodbye. It's weird how your brain remembers selective things. I remember being in the back of a car, trying to stay motionless. Almost impossible when you're so nervous, so young, getting smuggled from one country to the next. Again. I'm Saharzan, and this is my story. Me, the refugee.
That's coming up today at 2 here on Maine Public Radio.
The Trump administration's family separation policy sparked a national outcry.
Let the children go!
Tearing children from the arms of their mother and their father.
This is not America. This is not our country.
What we're doing as a nation is inflicting enormous harm.
I'm Ari Shapiro. 1 year on, we'll revisit that moment and look at how it's changed the debate about immigration in America. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening.
Welcome back. I'm Cindy Hahn, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, ticks, Lyme, and other vector-borne diseases. Joining me, Chuck Lubelchik. He's a vector ecologist. Rob Smith is an infectious disease specialist. And Michelle Walsh is our state veterinarian. Join our conversation. Give us a call. Our number is 1-800 399-3566. And we will go to a call from Harlan calling from Portland. Hi, Harlan. What's your question?
Hello. Thank you for having me. My question revolves around ticks at higher elevations. So I frequently hike in the White Mountains in New Hampshire and Maine. And I'm wondering if, A, there are more ticks or less ticks at higher elevation. And of those ticks, do they carry more diseases?
Chuck?
So we've done some surveys actually in and around the areas around the whites. And what we generally find is that deer ticks are present in areas near the White Mountains. They tend to occur at lower elevations. Deer ticks tend to be, we call them the Goldilocks syndrome. They don't like it too hot or too cold, too wet or too dry. And those conditions down near the base, around the areas of like Conway or Fryeburg, are kind of hospitable for the ticks. As you go into higher elevations, though, it's generally colder and more exposed, and the deer ticks do not do as well, but we have collected dog ticks at pretty close to tree line elevation in the whites before. And so dog ticks are certainly present pretty up high. So,
okay, thanks for your call, Harlan. I wanted to follow up a little bit about the prevention. Are there any new preventive sprays or medications or anything that are available? Have you heard of any new
techniques? Well, the standards for repellents to spray on your clothing or yourself, no. There is a lot of anecdotal information about people trying to apply things like, certain botanical compounds. The problem with a lot of that is, though, there's not a lot of good vetted data that says it works or doesn't work. Right now, we still have the standards that are a DEET-based compound. There is one botanical oil, lemon oil of eucalyptus, that's a base compound that has been shown to be effective. It does require probably more frequent applications because it tends to break down a lot quicker on the skin. But then other than that, we have another base compound called IR3535, which is found in some sprays. And then one also called picaridin, which is kind of newer in the last 5 to 10 years that seems to be very popular now in commercial brands.
Okay. And Rob, can you talk about the idea of a vaccine for Lyme disease?
Yeah. So there's also been a trial recently of a compound that you can take that might last in your system for the summer that would protect you from Lyme disease, from tick bites. It's under in research trials right now. It's not truly a vaccine, but it's a temporary protective compound. There's a lot of renewed interest in vaccination for Lyme disease and for these other tick-borne diseases. There actually was an approved Lyme disease vaccine back in the late 1990s and early 2000, and unfortunately, although it was 80% effective and appeared to be well-tolerated, it was not a commercial success and has not been reintroduced since it was there for several years. But now there are a couple of vaccines that are in trials. There's one vaccine that's in human trials now that's similar to the vaccine that was used back in 2000 but has some improvements. And there are also some really innovative new ideas about coming up with compounds that might vaccinate us against not only Lyme disease but some of these other agents that are in ticks. Unfortunately, the time frame to go from bench to clinical trials to approval of a vaccine is not short. And so there's a lot of good news around the work that's going on, but I think it's going to be a while before we have a vaccine.
So we have to be patient. How long is a while, you think?
Well, with the closest one, it conceivably could be 5 years or so if everything really looked great, but probably more we're looking at a decade kind of would be my guess.
So just use permethrin in the meantime, I guess. We have a question from Catherine on Facebook. We've seen a lot of ticks at our house, but fortunately they've been dog ticks and not deer ticks. My question is, will different species of ticks coexist, or is the fact that we've not seen any deer ticks this season indicate that the deer ticks are being pushed out by the dog ticks? Does it work that way?
No, they're not really pushed out, but they do in a lot of cases. There can be some overlap in the habitat they like, but in general, dog ticks are much more resistant to drying out, and so they tend to be found in much more exposed, dry areas like open fields, dunes with dune grass, things like that. And deer ticks are pretty sensitive to drying out, so they really like to have some kind of shaded cover, either a pretty good shrub layer or a forest canopy. So they're generally not found out in open, exposed areas like a lawn. Dog ticks, however, do just fine on a mowed lawn. They're pretty hardy. And so usually it's more of the habitat that they are occupying is distinct from one another.
Okay, we have an email from Seth. He says, we have a bad tick problem this year, and I'm hesitant to spray as I feel chemicals that kill bugs can kill birds and other wildlife. We were interested in the spray called Wonderside, which uses cedar oil and supposedly disrupts the octopamine receptors in pheromone-dependent pests like ticks, fleas, and mosquitoes, yet supposedly is safe for kids and pets and birds and mammals. Does your panel have any insight on whether this would be effective for treating yards without harming wildlife? Have you heard of that?
I have.
You have?
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. There is a compound out there. This is a compound, I think, based on red cedar. I know that folks at the University of Rhode Island were doing test trials on its efficacy. And the efficacy to control ticks with this compound was a lot lower than a traditional synthetic pesticide. I don't think it's particularly effective against dog ticks as well, which again are hardier. It may be somewhat effective against deer ticks, but I think you would not want to rely probably solely on it.
Okay. We are going to Rich now, calling from Moosehead. Hi, Rich. Did you have a question or comment?
Yes, I just had a comment and I'd like to hear the response to it. I grew up on Cape Ann, Massachusetts, with a father that was an Audubon naturalist, and he lived by Rachel Carson. And our vet had us use Murphy's oil soap to wash our horses, dogs, et cetera, and it worked. So I'll just take any comments off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Rich. What do you think, Michelle? Have you heard of those types of natural defenses or natural preventive measures?
I can't say that I've ever heard of recommending Murphy's oil soap to wash your pets in. But I will say that there, what may have been going on there is that actually bathing a pet will dislodge not attached ticks, but ticks who haven't yet settled down to find a meal. The other thing that the preventatives that we use on companion animals do is it actually impairs the ability of the tick to find a place to take a meal. And if they do attach, they attach weakly. So, and I mean W-E-A-K weakly.
Right.
So you actually may be able to dislodge them more easily if you're bathing a pet. Now, if you are thinking about bathing your cat daily, you're probably not going to do that. You know, it's not that practical. But, you know, the repellents are a really good idea for our pets, and we're lucky that we have those as an option. But I think all the preventative measures that both the callers and your guests here have mentioned are all really important. They're all part of the arsenal to protect ourselves. But the prevention is really the way to go with this stuff and to allow us to actually safely cohabitate with these parasites.
Right.
Because we have to.
And that's related to Anita's question. Anita on Facebook says, I help lead lots of nature education programs with kids in the forest behind our local school. Is there anything we can do to limit the number of ticks in the woods along the trails? Parents are often fearful and don't want their kids outside because of tick concerns. Which is sad, right? You want the kids outside.
Yeah, it's actually a big concern, especially in areas like, you know, I would say Acadia is a good example where there is a concern that people don't want to recreate because they're worried about ticks. And of course, we want to experience as much of the outdoors as we can in Maine because it's a beautiful state. So there are things you can do, like behind schools, on trails, town forests. Widening the trails as much as possible is great. Trying to keep kids to the center of a trail, or if you're walking your dogs to the center of a trail, is a really great idea. And you can apply what would be called a barrier treatment of spray to control ticks in very limited areas, and it's maybe a band that's maybe 3 to 6 feet wide on either side of the trail. And that would certainly help to reduce ticks at the greatest area of exposure, which is going to be right along those trail edges.
Okay, and there's an email from Julie. My main company, Dog Not Gone, manufactures tick-repelling apparel for pet and people. We use a permethrin-treated fabric for all our products, which are designed, stitched, and sold in our Skowhegan factory. I'm a huge advocate of using permethrin or permethrin. I keep
same
either
thing.
One. Okay. Permethrin to repel ticks and biting insects. Most experts agree that it's the best way to protect ourselves from insect-borne disease. You can either treat your clothing with the liquid permethrin, which lasts 5 to 7 washings, or use clothing that is made with fabric that has been permanently treated and lasts 70 washings. Does that sound about right?
Yes, and I probably will be looking her up since
okay.
I have two
well,
dogs.
Okay, well, it's Dog Not Gone, and Julie, I encourage you to post that on our Facebook page if you haven't already. We will go now to Frank calling from Farmington. Hi, Frank. You're on Maine Calling.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So it's kind of along the same lines of the natural remedies, but are there any natural things, essential oil type things that keep ticks off in the woods, especially for kids? And then I guess the second part of the question was, there are Epsom salt infused with those as well, essential oils as well. And I didn't know if bathing in that after a walk in the woods would be good to dislodge or if that would actually exacerbate the problem. So I'll take comments off there.
Thank you, Frank. What do you think about the Epsom salts or the natural lavender oils and different kinds of other approaches?
I don't. There's not a lot of data out there, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. It's not to say it doesn't work, but the data just is not there. And as for the repellents, I mean, the only one that has really been vetted strongly is the lemon oil of eucalyptus as a repellent that you could spray on skin or fabric. And that is a botanical. You can find it in a bunch of different commercial products that are sold at outdoor places, garden centers, things like that. So that would be the closest that we really have good data for, would be a lemon oil of eucalyptus product.
Okay, we're already getting close to the end of the show. So, Rob, I wanted to quickly touch upon some of the other vector-borne diseases. I know we could talk forever about Lyme, but are there other ones, particularly in Maine, that are something to watch for?
Yes, definitely, and particularly in the elderly population and in people who have immune suppressing conditions. There are two diseases that can be very serious that we've seen on the rise in Maine. The first is anaplasmosis, has been mentioned a few times, is a bacterial infection. And we've seen a 600% increase in reports of this disease over the last 5 years or so. Some of this is due to increased recognition of it and better diagnostic tests for it. And fortunately, that disease responds very well to one antibiotic, doxycycline. Unfortunately, we don't have other antibiotics that have been well tested for that disease, so we rely on one antibiotic to treat it. But it is an increasing problem in our state. And the other one I mentioned briefly earlier is called babesiosis, which is a malaria-like illness. Way back, used to be called Nantucket fever when it was first recognized in the 1970s because it was localized, it was thought, to that island. But in fact, we've seen as the deer tick has spread throughout the Northeast that babesiosis tends to appear in areas where there's a lot of deer tick activity. And we're seeing, we've gone from a few cases a year recognized in Maine to, I think, 100 last year. And this disease can also cause people to become quite severely ill and requires a different kind of treatment than we use for the other two we've mentioned.
Okay, I'm going to try to squeeze real quick. Tweet from Jeff, how effective is having chickens to control the tick population around your house? Oh. They eat them, right? No,
It's like it's an urban. It's kind of an urban legend. I think anybody that has chickens know they completely denude the landscape around them. So they may, but we don't know that it really proven to reduce Lyme disease risk.
Okay,
they also carry ticks.
Oh, so that's kind of a wash. All right, and one fast other question from email from John: is there a peak tick season? And are we getting there right now?
Yeah, dog ticks, we are just past the peak. Their numbers are really high right now. Deer tick nymphs are peaking in the next week or so, probably. So,
okay.
And then they'll decline into July.
I mean, what about time of day?
Well, early morning, late afternoon, the middle of the day when it's high sun, not as much.
Okay, that's going to have to be. I know there's a lot more questions. Sorry we didn't get to everything, but that's about it. Michelle, Chuck, and Rob, thank you all for joining us today. Michelle Walsh is Maine State Veterinarian. Chuck Lubelchik is a vector ecologist with the Lyme and Vector-Borne Disease Lab. And Rob Smith is director and founder of the Vector-Borne Disease Lab and infectious disease specialist. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. Julie Pike took your calls. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as helpful links at mainecalling.org. Today's show will be rebroadcast at 8. I'm Cindy Hahn. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.